Welcome to On Mic, conversations from Northgate Hall, the home of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the school. As one of the nation's top journalism programs, we regularly host the world's best reporters, writers, and documentarians to talk about the stories behind their stories. This week, one of our instructors, Deirdre English, invited author and columnist Rosa Brooks into the studio to talk about her book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Brooks teaches law at Georgetown University and is a scholar at West Point's Modern War Institute. Here, she shares her thoughts on the war on terror, the expanding role of the U.S. military, and what happens when the boundaries dissolve between war and peace. It's On Mic, Deirdre English in conversation with Rosa Brooks.
Let's start with this title, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. This is really encompassing a period of time, how this happened over a period of time, and that period of time, I take it, was started with 9/11.
Yeah. In fact, I think it started earlier, but 9/11 is the moment we all noticed that it was happening, I guess. Think of it like this. I think for most people in your generation and my generation, our paradigm of war was probably formed by watching World War II movies, maybe Vietnam movies, and thinking of war as something that involved large groups of uniformed soldiers trying to take or defend territory. But then what happened was 9/11, and the 9/11 attacks were something that they're very hard to categorize, and I think that for younger people don't always realize that it wasn't inevitable that we were going to enter a war on terrorism. When the 9/11 attacks happened, they were obviously incredibly shocking. It was the largest number of deaths on U.S. soil caused by, you know, an intentional act, really since the American Civil War. There were more deaths on September 11th, 2001 than there were in the Pearl Harbor attacks, just to you know, give it some sense of perspective. And it was incredibly shocking. And one of the issues that immediately came up is what is this? Here we had this terrible thing that was clearly an intentional act that had been carried out by private citizens. They weren't part of a state. They weren't part of an army. They came from multiple different countries. They didn't wear uniforms, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't know what to do with this. And a lot of people argued at the time that this was just a crime. It was a horrific crime. It was a crime against humanity level of crime. But it was nonetheless in the legal world and the political world of crime. Others, and this became the view that won out because it was the view of several successive U.S. presidential administrations, was that this was an act of war. And the argument for act of war was, well, yeah, they're not part of an army and they're from multiple different states, but the level of death and destruction and violence is on a scale that we associate with war. There are non-U.S. actors. They're foreign actors. And they say they're in a war with us. Osama bin Laden had said, I'm at war with the United States. And so it's an act of war and we're going to have a war on terrorism. That sounds maybe to people who, you know, to non-lawyers, that may sound like that's just a metaphor, right? You know, you could have a war on poverty, you could have a war on drugs. And in fact, ironically, the very day before the September 11th attacks, September 10th, 2001, President George W. Bush was in Florida for part of a launch a campaign against illiteracy. And he gave a speech in which he said, we have to declare war on illiteracy. And needless to say, nobody thought that was anything other than a metaphor. It was just a metaphor. Nobody thought he was going to start, you know, bombing illiteracy out of existence or anything. But I think it became apparent very, very quickly after the attacks the very next day that the war on terrorism was not intended as a metaphor. It was intended both as a statement about how we were going to respond. We were going to use military force rather than the tools of law enforcement to respond. And it was a statement about what legal framework operated. And I can say a little bit more about that. But it was a statement about a very different set of legal principles about state power and individual rights.
There's so much to talk about just about this. You know, going to war on terror, what does that even mean? Is terror, terror is not a state. Terror is not an army. Terror is a method. So how do you go to war on terror? But what difference do you think it might have made if it had been treated as an international crime and not as an act of war?
It's a great thought experiment. I think that we probably would have seen a much reduced expansion of executive power in all kinds of ways. I think that we might never have gotten to a Donald Trump. I think that America's relationships with, in particular, the Islamic world would probably be different and perhaps a good deal more positive. And this is not to say that there was some magic thing that was going to make everybody love each other and feel happy. But I do think that choosing to go down that war road led us to some terribly bad decisions.
But I'd like to ask you a little bit more specifically, not just the consequences, but literally what would have happened if it had been treated as an international crime and not an act of war.
So if it had been treated as an international crime, we would have done some of the things that we did anyway. There's nothing in either international or in domestic law that prohibits you from using military resources and indeed military force to respond to a crime that originates overseas. So I think we probably still would have gone after bin Laden. I don't think we would have decided to launch a full-scale invasion of Afghanistan with over 100,000 troops. I don't think we would have invaded Iraq. I think the focus would have been much more on following that trail, which ultimately did lead us to, you know, who were the 9/11 attackers, who were their families, what were the financial networks supporting them. And I think we would have responded through a combination of civilian criminal legal process against those who we could find and cooperation with other states to get people arrested and brought to justice who weren't in the United States, with international sanctions of various sorts. And we did those things, too, in the end. Or at least some of those things. But the primary response was this very militarized response.
And, you know, it really strikes me, here we are at the Graduate School of Journalism, and once again, this is On Mic, and we're talking to Rosa Brooks. And Rosa is a professor at the Georgetown Law School, but she's also a writer, and she's written her book in a way that's really very much for the general reader. Let's go back to something else that you say about 9/11. You write, a global war on terror, you know, that at that time, you intuitively knew that it would be a war that could, by its nature, have no boundaries, no geographic limits, no limits on who could be targeted, captured, or killed, and no end. But you write, if there was, at the same time, if there was going to be war and struggle, I wanted to somehow be a part of it. So that is a really energetic impulse on your part to want to get on the inside and see it from the inside, where perhaps you could also make a difference.
Yeah. No, and going back to the parts of the book that you mentioned that talk about my own background, one of the things that shifted my own view of the military actually happened before 9/11. I was working for various human rights organizations, and I worked for a while for the State Department's Human Rights Bureau. I was working in places like Kosovo and Sierra Leone, and this is sort of set against the backdrop of the ethnic violence in the former Yugoslavia, the genocide in Rwanda, and so forth. And so for the first time, I saw military interventions that, despite all kinds of ambiguities associated with them, to me, ultimately, clearly saved lives and were in the service of humanitarian and human rights ideals. And I saw military personnel on the ground in those places trying their best to help rebuild really shattered societies. And I think for me, that was the first thing that let me go, I was brought up to assume that everything about the military is bad, that people in the military just want to fight wars and that's a bad thing. And what I encountered was the fact, and this is a major theme of the book, that a lot of what the military does is not all that military, if you will. And increasingly, and this began before 9/11, but accelerated more dramatically, very dramatically after 9/11, we increasingly have used our military for everything from humanitarian relief operations, earthquakes, tsunamis, that sort of thing, to doing what once upon a time we had civilians doing, which is economic development programs, governance programs, training judges and parliamentarians. You name it, we have military personnel somewhere in the world doing it. That you could say we have militarized American foreign policy, and I think that that would be true. You could also say that we have civilianized our military in all kinds of ways, and that would be true too. And that civilianization of our military, the vast majority of military personnel never have and never will hear a weapon fired in anger. You know, that's not what they do. Only 15% of our military personnel, even after 16 years of solid war, only 15% are in what the military calls combat occupational specialties, like infantry or armor. The rest do things. They're truck mechanics, and they take pictures for military websites, and they're payroll clerks, and they do civil society building activities, and you name it. But they're not trained to be fighters first and foremost, and that's not what they do. And even if they end up deployed to combat areas, most of the military personnel we sent off to Iraq and Afghanistan during the peaks of ground combat there weren't involved in it. You know, they were doing something else, which is not to say, obviously, that U.S. troops don't drop, you know, don't get into firefights, that we don't drop bombs on people, that people don't kill and get killed. They do. But that coexists with this whole
and come
world.
Back injured and come back with PTSD and all these things are still major factors.
All kinds of complicated things. But that in fact, why the title of my book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, as the title suggests, there are really two stories that the book talks about.
Yes.
One of those stories is how after 9/11, we began as a nation to view every security threat, every problem in the world through the lens of war, institutionally and legally. And the other story is how, partly as a consequence of that, partly as a driver of that, partly as a consequence of that, we began to view the military as the all-purpose tool for solving every problem.
Right. And so, yes, yeah, so these are the two major frames of your book, and we want to really spell these out. So one of the things that happened is that an enormous infusion of money into the military. And you've worked in the State Department and in the Defense Department. Could you just describe the difference in resources?
Well,
what does the State Department do, you know,
less and less
to bring about peace, and how well funded is it?
I mean, the military budget has always dwarfed the diplomacy and development budgets, but that the disproportion has just grown in the last 15 years. And it's commonly said that there are more members of military marching bands in the U.S. military than there are members of the U.S. Foreign Service. And for years, I thought, that can't be true. That's just something people say. It sounds really, sounds good, but surely not. It is, in fact, true. There are a lot more members of military marching bands in the United States government's employ than there are Foreign Service officers. I think that these things, you know, this is not a coincidence. It's the old cliche about, you know, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If your only tool is the military, everything looks like a war. The more everything looks like a war, the more everything looks like a job for the military. And you end up in where we are now, which is in a vicious circle.
Yeah,
you underfund the civilian branches of government very
well,
badly.
Well, let's describe that vicious circle. You get into it in some detail. What is that vicious circle?
So
how does it work?
The vicious circle is that you start seeing every security threat through the frame of war, and that's transnational non-state terrorism. We start seeing through the legal and institutional framework of war, and I should talk at some point a little bit about what the legal implications of this are, but put that aside for now. We start viewing cyber primarily through the lens of war, and we start viewing, you know, even climate change increasingly, you know, viewed through the lens of security, threat, and war. The more you view through the lens of war, the more you're going to assign tasks associated with responding to those different kinds of threats to the U.S. military, because that's the institution that does war. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the more tasks you assign to the U.S. military, particularly if you're assigning them tasks that are not their traditional areas of expertise, well, you have to train people, you have to spend money to get them good at stuff that they didn't used to be good at. So you have to increase military budgets to enable the military to do all these new things. The more you increase military budgets, the more you're going to look for savings elsewhere. And we look for savings in, you know, our diplomacy and development budgets, among other places. So you start freezing or cutting the budgets of the State Department, USAID, et cetera. The more you cut their budgets, the less capable they are, because they don't have any money anymore, which means that you turn more and more to the military, because they have the people, they have the capability. And remember, the military, I believe the U.S. Department of Defense is still the largest employer in the world. You know, DOD employs about 3 million people, roughly, if you include civilians, active duty military, and reserves, the National Guard. It's huge. The U.S. military can get more people and more stuff to more places in less time than any other institution on earth. It's quite amazing. And it's you know, that's our hammer. And
yeah,
everything looks like a nail.
And you give a great example of that had to do with agriculture in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I'd love you to tell that story.
No, and this is a story that one of my friends, a retired Army lieutenant general named Paul Eaton, told me with some, you know, frustration in his voice as he told this story. He said he's in Afghanistan. It's 2006, 2007. He's at that point, you know, I don't remember what he was. He's a colonel, or he's a one-star general or something at that point. And he begins to realize that in the district of Afghanistan for which he has responsibility, that there's not going to be any lasting peace or stability unless Afghans can become less dependent on opium poppy cultivation.
Because poppies are the major crop in Afghanistan.
It's a major source of income
for the Taliban. Opioid crisis.
Source of the opioid crisis, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And the Taliban is making a ton of money off of this. And so he essentially, this is not obviously literally the sequence of events, but, you know, he talks to his superiors in the Army, calls up the Department of Agriculture back in Washington and said, oh, we've had this insight. You know, what we really need here is not any more shooters. We need some people here who can help with Afghan agricultural reform. And of course, the Department of Agriculture people sort of say, well, you know, there are only three of us and we're really busy. And besides, we don't really want to go to Afghanistan because it's a war and we're not soldiers. And good luck. Goodbye. And so the Army in frustration starts searching the databases looking for reservists who have some agricultural background. And of course, they find them. You know, they find farmers and they find people who work for agriculture companies, and probably they find a bunch of people just like gardening or something. I don't know. But a year later, the Army has essentially a battalion's worth of reservists in the U.S. Army who, at least in theory, know something about agriculture. And there they are. They're in Afghanistan. And as Paul Eaton said, they're not necessarily the right people. You know, being a farmer or whatever it is in the United States does not automatically translate into being an expert on agricultural reform in a barely developing country in the middle of a war. But the Army could get 1,000 people there, and the Army could do it quickly, and the people don't get to say, no, I don't feel like it. They have to say yes, because that's the deal if you're in the military.
It's a fascinating case study, really. I don't know if you know anything about how it all worked out or what the state
you can see for yourself that Afghanistan is now an oasis of stability.
Well, I mean, because it's so interesting, because logically, it would seem as though nothing would be more important or more helpful to the war effort than to encourage Afghani farmers to stop growing poppies and selling them to the Taliban and fueling the world opioid crisis. So that's a strategic goal that one would think that politicians and the State Department and the Defense Department could all agree on.
Mm-hmm.
But you describe a very haphazard,
half-assed
attempt.
And in theory, at that time, they did all agree on this, right? This was certainly by the time President Obama took office in January of 2009, there was very widespread agreement in theory in the sort of Washington foreign policy and national security establishment, if you will, that the things needed to be, quote, rebalanced, that they'd gotten sort of tilted too much onto the military side. And then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was Secretary of Defense while I worked at the Pentagon, and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, made a number of public appearances together where they would say things like, Secretary Gates would say things like, our military efforts will be ineffective if they are not matched by, you know, commensurate investment in diplomacy and development. The trouble is it never really quite happened. I mean, there was talk when I was at the Pentagon, there was supposed to be a civilian surge in Afghanistan, but it was sort of too late already, right? And the civilian surge ended up amounting to a few hundred extra people. But compared that to the size and scale of the military presence in Afghanistan, at the time there were over 100,000 U.S. troops. Sending a couple hundred civilians is a big deal compared to the size of the diplomatic corps, big deals compared to the size of the USAID staff, peanuts relative to the size of the military. Many military leaders, including our current Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, retired U.S. Commander of Central Command, four-star Marine general, once said, testifying to Congress when he was CENTCOM commander, he said, if you're not going to spend money on diplomacy and development, you're going to need to buy me more ammunition. And I think that there's a very clear understanding on the part of military leaders that the less we invest in the civilian side, the more we leave to the military and the more we're going to have conflicts that will be intractable. But as a nation, Congress has shown essentially zero interest in doing anything about this. And under President Trump, I think all of the bad dynamics have not only will not be averted, but in fact have been embraced by the president himself and by some members of his administration. So we're seeing the opposite of what I wish we could see.
Yeah. And you're describing a gaping gulf between the military mindset and what the military is good at doing and the need for a strategy, a more civilian-driven strategy of development
and
diplomacy.
And what the military has tried to do in many, many ways to its institutional credit, right, is say, okay, we don't think we're really that good at this stuff, but if you, nation, are telling us we've got to do it, we'll do it.
And we have the money.
And we've got money.
We have the money and the people.
We got money
and we're
and
all
got
over
people.
The globe. We're,
right.
We have U.S. bases everywhere.
Yeah.
We have U.S. personnel in far more countries than most
right.
Americans realize. We're there. We don't really have anything much to do in a lot of these places.
Well, and so you have all these young captains who were taught how to do, you know, combined arms maneuver or whatever their own, you know, whatever it is, who are then being told, yeah, figure out how to advance women's human rights in wherever. And they're kind of going, all right, okay, yes, sir. How do I do that? And they're trying to figure, and they're doing the best they can, but and there is a very significant extent to which the Defense Department has tried to really ramp up training to increase regional expertise, to increase issue area expertise, and so forth. So the military has turned. It's not your daddy's military.
Well,
right?
This is what your title says.
Yeah.
You know how the military became everything.
Mm-hmm.
First, everything
mm-hmm.
became war, and we could still talk about that more. You know what that means up to date, and you know what it means in terms of today's headlines. But right now we're talking about how the military became everything.
Yeah.
So they're social workers, they're farmers,
they're vaccinating cattle in Botswana.
What else are
they're
they
fighting
doing?
Ebola. They're making videos about how peaceful negotiation is better than conflict. You know, I mean, they're doing all kinds of stuff that even 2 decades ago, the military had an acronym for that kind of thing, and it was a rather dismissive acronym. It was
They were considered to be military operations other than war. And if you work out the acronym for that, it's MOOT-W is how it worked out. And it was pronounced Mootwa, as in that is moot. And that gives you a little sense of how it was regarded by the military two decades ago. Was there's this, you know, well, we are forced to send a bunch of people to Bosnia to engage in Mootwa, and they were really sulky about it, you know, that they didn't see it as their job. Whereas since then, it has been in many ways through a combination of the evolution of counterinsurgency doctrine, stability operations doctrine. It is no longer considered, you know, Mootwa, something else that you do every now and then temporarily because you have to. It's increasingly become a really central part of what the military does.
Yeah. And also, would it be fair to say that while the military has been evolving all of these other functions, it has, some people would argue that it has been failing as a military, failed in Afghanistan, failed in Iraq, failed in Libya, and failed in Syria as a military to achieve our military goals?
Well, I think that's a complicated question, right? Because this, again, goes back to what's our paradigm of war, right? And how the conflicts we are involved in today are different. If your paradigm of war is the United States fights with Germany and eventually somebody surrenders and the war is over, we're failing. If your paradigm is terrorism and insurgency, then almost by definition, there's no end to these conflicts. So I think we are engaging in a type of conflict that by its nature can and will have no decisive victory.
Well, what do you say to the argument that our war on terror has produced more terror?
I think it has. I think unquestionably it has. And that's a somewhat different issue, right? Mm-hmm. And I think many military leaders would be the first to say, you know, you want us to bomb people, we can bomb people. You want us to kill people, we can kill people. But that will not necessarily help this country achieve its political objectives. And I think that
this country, the U.S.,
this country, the United States. Yeah. And I think we have quite consistently, you know, as we've been saying, we have, you know, we have taken, you know, what's often derisively called the whack-a-mole approach to counterterrorism, where, you know, a terrorist head pops up, we kill them, and then we're kind of surprised when all their friends and relations are really angry at us, and next thing you know, there's another terrorist, and we kill them, and so it goes.
Well, and I don't know what you could tell me about what the figures are, but in terms of the number of civilian war-related deaths, not necessarily killed by the U.S. military, but war-related deaths in Iraq, I've seen figures as high as 500,000. Do you think that's...
I think that we will never know with any enormous amount of accuracy how many civilians died, but clearly a lot is the answer. And it partly, of course, depends on, are we only counting people who were killed by bullets or bombs? Are we also counting people who died of preventable diseases as a result of the collapse of healthcare systems and sanitation systems? But I think no question.
Those are not exactly nation building.
Yeah, no question. The costs have been astronomical to civilians in Iraq and continue to be so.
This book, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, you've really impressed people across the political spectrum in a great rave review by the venerable journalist Harold Evans in the New York Times Book Review. He wrote, his first line is Rosa Brooks psychic? He basically goes on to say that you provided a framework of understanding this period that we're in that is very predictive of the kinds of things that we see happening in the news. At that time, he was talking about episodes like, violence in this country, the militarization of the police force, the access that crazy people have to military-style weapons, but also the breakdown of the distinctions between civilian law and military law. So this brings me back to what we want to talk about for a little while right now, which is What is the difference between military law and civilian law, or what the law of war and the law of peace?
The differences are enormous and of just unbelievable significance. And I think this is something that a lot of lay people don't realize, that when you decide to call something a war, you're not merely it's not obviously not just a metaphor when it comes to, for instance, counterterrorism, but or cyber, increasingly in the news these days, and you're not just invoking one institution, the military, over another set of civilian institutions. You're also making a choice between two radically different legal frameworks. And to put it at its bluntest, this is so obvious, I think, that people forget it over and over again, right? In ordinary peacetime life, walking around in the streets of Berkeley, you don't get to kill people. And if you know, I always use this example, you know, if we walk outside the Berkeley School of Journalism here, and I take that, you know, heavy copy of my book and I hit the nearest passerby over the head with it, and I hit them so hard that they die, you know, what is going to happen is that the police are presumably going to come and they're going to arrest me, and I'm going to be charged with murder, and I'm going to be put on trial and so forth. And if I say to them, when they say, well, why did you kill that person? If I say, you know, he was my enemy, that will just get the mental health professionals involved. On the other hand, when it comes to war, we expect people to kill. And the legal terminology is that there's something called combatant immunity, immunity from the ordinary consequences of the legal process, that when a soldier kills an enemy combatant in wartime, it's not murder. You don't get prosecuted. You don't go to jail. You might even get a medal. You might even be punished if you don't kill the enemy. You are required under certain circumstances to kill. You could be jailed for desertion, which is still, you know, it's still a crime. And we've prosecuted people for that. So the peacetime legal framework emphasizes individual rights. It emphasizes due process. It emphasizes limitations on the state use of force, that we don't allow our police to just say, well, there are some suspected criminals who live over there. Let's just bomb that apartment block. And if any civilians are killed, that's just, you know, collateral damage. We don't let them do that. We have this very individualized approach. They have to get warrants and so on. The death penalty, the state killing of citizens, is extraordinarily rare and requires very complex legal processes. On the other hand, the law of armed conflict, it's a body of international law, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, et cetera, what we call the law of armed conflict, which is part of U.S. law as well, made by act of Congress and various court decisions, part of U.S. law, it's reflected in our Uniform Code of Military Justice, is radically different. The law of armed conflict says, you get to kill the enemy, not because he's trying to kill you or because you got a warrant and a judge says it's okay, but because he's the enemy. That's why you get to kill him. If the enemy is sleeping, you still get to kill him, etc. If you don't kill the enemy, maybe you get in trouble. So the emphasis, instead of being on individual rights, due process, and restraints on the state's coercive and lethal powers, the law of armed conflict, law of war, is very permissive when it comes to the state's use of force and use of other coercive methods, lethal force and coercion, and not interested in individual rights at all. So the minute you decide that something belongs in the legal landscape of war, you magically change what the legal requirements and constraints are. And let me give an example that makes this more concrete in terms of how it affects our foreign policy and counterterrorism. Take a subject that has been very controversial in the last 3 or 4 years, U.S. drone strikes. If we think that so-and-so, a suspected terrorist in Somalia or Yemen or Libya or Pakistan or wherever, if we decide that we're in a war against terrorism or war against, as we still legally insist, Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and we assert that this particular individual is a combatant in that armed conflict with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and you leave aside, you know, who are the associated forces? How do we know they're associated forces? How do we know that somebody's a combatant when we're talking about non-state actors, no uniforms, et cetera? But if that's our framework, then if that's our framework and we want to use a drone strike or, for that matter, a special operations raid or whatever, a poisoned umbrella, it makes no difference, to kill that person, then it is just a lawful targeting of an enemy combatant. And from a legal and moral perspective, it is identical to an American on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day shooting at a German soldier who's rushing towards him with a machine gun. They're legally identical. There's just no issue. You don't need a warrant. You don't get a judge. You don't get in trouble. You don't have to prove after the fact that you got the right guy. It's enough to say, hey, he was an enemy combatant. What do you want? On the other hand, if we're not so sure that it makes sense, it's valid legally to speak about an armed conflict against Al-Qaeda and associated forces, or we don't think the armed conflict is in Yemen or Libya or wherever it happens to be, or we're not so sure that this person counts as a combatant, well, then the U.S. just murdered somebody with no judicial process, and that's a pretty crappy thing to do, right? And you really want to know the difference. Because depending on which legal framework you choose, either the U.S. there's nothing new here, ma'am, move right along, or the U.S. is going around the world murdering people. And the trouble is we now inhabit a world where the legal categories that we're using just can't be applied in any coherent way. So the law has become, if you will, it's essentially kind of indeterminate. You know, that you can argue forever about whether person A or person B counts as an enemy combatant in an armed conflict. And we have argued forever. I've sat in so many rooms with so many smart lawyers for the U.S. government, for the military, for allied governments, for NGOs, international organizations, academics, who just argue till they're blue in the face. And it's, you say potato, I say potato. There's no basis for making that distinction anymore. And that's another big theme of the book, that we've inherited these legal categories that can't be applied in a consistent or principled way anymore. And the result, of course, is that now we're up to the third U.S. presidential administration. It started with George W. Bush, Barack Obama, now Donald Trump, who faced with a choice of, gee, Mr. President, do you want to consider this under do you want to consider this war? Or do you want to consider this something else? International law enforcement have said, gee, if I have a choice between the legal framework that lets me do pretty much whatever I want with no judicial scrutiny, et cetera, or the legal framework in which I'm very constrained, I think I'll take the legal framework where I get to do whatever I want. And that, in turn, further fuels this tendency to view everything as war, because then you're more unconstrained if you're the U.S. executive branch.
Yes. And haven't you warned that with our strategy on targeted killings, drone strikes, that we have opened a kind of a Pandora's box in which, what are your concerns, if you're psychic, as Harold Evans thinks?
I'm not psychic, sadly.
What are your warnings and your concerns about where this could lead?
My worry is that, talk about things that undermine the rule of law. When the U.S., with things like targeted strikes, drone strikes, we're essentially asserting that we get to decide, we, the United States government, we get to decide what counts as a war, who counts as a combatant, and we're going to base all of that on evidence that we're not going to make public, and we're going to evaluate that evidence in a secret process that we're also not going to make public, involving individuals whose identities we won't reveal except at the, we know who the president is, we know who the commanding general is and the head of the CIA is. But other than that, we don't know the names of the people involved in targeting decisions. But we get to kill people anywhere in the world based on secret evidence in a secret process. And everybody just has to trust us when we say, no, we swear, we're very careful. The trouble is that a lot of bad guys in the world, whether they're North Koreans or Russians or Iranians or terrorists for that matter, how would we react when they say the same thing? And the answer is we don't tend to react very well. If Vladimir Putin says, that wasn't a dissident who just died under mysterious circumstances, that was an enemy combatant, Russia faces a very serious terrorist threat, What is our evidence? Well, unfortunately, we can't share that with you. It's classified. We know you understand. You know, we've opened up the door for every bad actor in the world to say exactly that, and we have no
Putin is accused of killing many of his enemies by poisoning them in places like London.
Yeah. And the really depressing thing, of course, is that we had a president who at least felt kind of conflicted about this, right? Barack Obama dramatically expanded America's targeted killing program. But at least he felt kind of conflicted.
He was a law professor too.
Yes, he acknowledged that this presents some issues. Mm-hmm. Whereas Donald Trump, as we know, famously, when told that Putin was a killer, said, "What, you think we're so innocent? We got killers too." And Donald Trump clearly has not the slightest moral, ethical, or legal reservation about any of this. So we are in a landscape where all of the trends that I describe in the book, which was written, of course, prior to
yes.
Donald Trump's election or indeed the campaign, have just gotten worse.
Yes. And I was just about to think about that with you, that you did write this book when Obama was president and when you probably, like a lot of other coastal liberals, thought that Hillary was going
hey,
to be...
who are you calling a coastal liberal?
was going
Take
to...
that back.
Okay. I'll call you whatever you want. You know, as I read your book, I found myself thinking that there's a dystopian vision in here, almost a dystopian futuristic novel at war with a more hopeful practical strategy that you try to further. So, you know, you're not psychic, and you didn't know that Trump would be president, and you didn't know what he would do. But now that he is here, he's clearly going to expand the military budget, give more money to the military, and we do see him behaving like a military commander. I mean, for example, this week there was a terrorist act in New York, and he immediately pronounced that that person should get the death penalty and should go to Guantanamo.
Let's not insult military commanders by saying he's behaving like a military commander. He's not. He's behaving like as he usually does, like someone who is unstable, ignorant, and erratic. I think that, in fact, most military commanders have tended to express a strong preference for civilian trials.
Fair enough.
Like
yeah.
This.
Yeah. So that's what an interesting reversal you point to.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, maybe because of the history of counterinsurgency theory and because of the very civilianization of the military
yeah.
that's gone on, the way in which they've expanded and taken on so many more roles, maybe they are more aware.
Well, that's one of the many weird ironies of this political moment. You know, many people have commented on the number of former military personnel in high levels of the Trump administration, including obviously Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, H.R. McMaster, who's still an active duty three-star general, as National Security Advisor, John Kelly, retired four-star Marine general, as now former head of Homeland Security, now White House Chief of Staff. And asked the question of, is this sort of the, you know, does this represent a kind of quiet military takeover? And on the one hand, I think that that's completely overstated. Barack Obama actually appointed as many former high-ranking military people in to his administration as Trump has. On the other hand, you know, one of the many ironies is that there have been all kinds of ways in which the military on the Pentagon under Secretary of Defense, former General Jim Mattis, has been a little bit of a break on some of Trump's worst impulses. And that in turn has led to, you know, a sort of counter critique that the military is not respecting civilian authority. I mean, for instance, when Donald Trump tweeted out that he was, you know, getting transgender people out of the military, the Pentagon's response was sort of along the lines of, what is a tweet? You know, we're not doing anything. And ultimately, the executive order that came down the pike on transgendered military personnel was a lot more muted than Trump's initial pronouncements, I think in part because of the somewhat tempering influence of senior military leaders. And Mattis also famously managed to talk Trump out of the idea that reinstituting waterboarding and torture would be a good idea and just said no, you know, and Trump somewhat astonishingly said, well, all right, I still think it's a good idea, but, you know, I'll defer to my generals, as he puts it. So weirdly, we're at a moment when, and in the wake of the Charlottesville incidents, you know, we heard military leaders coming out and making incredibly strong statements about the importance of tolerance, diversity, anti-racism. You know, for instance, the chief of staff of the Air Force had a just fantastic remarks. He just said, you know, if you can't respect people of other races, genders, et cetera, you need to get out of this military. So I think the military in some ways, you know, has internalized some of the norms of our democratic process more effectively than our current president has internalized them, which is not to say that the dystopian trends I talk about in the book, I think, are probably unstoppable. You know, that it's not a great situation when the we're left hoping that the military will protect us from the authoritarian impulses of our president. That's not a great place to be. And I will, by the way, if I can put in a little plug for a podcast that I do with some of my former colleagues from Foreign Policy Magazine.
Yeah, please do.
We have a twice-weekly podcast that some of your listeners might enjoy. And if they're interested in sort of keeping up on the latest foreign policy and national security issues, we have a podcast called Deep State Radio, which we do twice a week, and you can find it on iTunes and on all of the usual podcast channels. And I promise that it is a lot of fun, and you can find out all about what the deep state is thinking.
I just want to end on a note of about journalism, because why have you chosen, you know, despite all of your responsibilities as a law professor and the kinds of things that you think about that are, you know, rather arcane in some cases.
Hey.
why have you chosen to write this book very much for the general reader? Not that law professors wouldn't find it illuminating as well, and I think they have, but, and why do you do that and the podcast and you had a column in the LA Times for a long time. What motivates you to do that kind of journalistic work?
Yeah, it's wanting to talk to a larger audience. And I think one of the great tragedies of the last few decades has been the drift of academia away from public policy and away from sort of the great debates of our time. And, you know, for all kinds of reasons, in terms of, you know, internal institutional incentives, academics really are really discouraged in many ways from writing for a more general audience. But the problem with that is that you're just talking to a tiny self-referential group of people a lot of the time. And quite a lot of the issues I talk about in How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, I talked about in law review articles before I wrote the book. And in fact, there was a law review article I wrote in 2004 called War Everywhere in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review, that in many ways contains the germ of the arguments that appear over a decade later in this book. But there have been some studies of law review articles, which it's just too depressing to give you the actual numbers, but essentially discovering, you know, nobody reads them, nobody cites them. Even a really successful law review article will be, you know, read and cited by a couple hundred people. And when you are writing about issues that you care about deeply, you know, to me, yes, of course, you should write to a specialized audience as well. You know, I do believe in expertise. I do believe in the value of specialized debates. But you want to talk to a larger audience. And one of the things for me that has been most gratifying about this book and writing this book and the reception of this book has been so many people in the military, civilians all over the country, overseas, who have reached out to me and said, you know, I really appreciated this book. It helped me understand things I didn't understand. It really made me think. It changed the way I think about certain issues. And, you know, that's what we all want.
Well, it's an important book for them, and it's an important book for journalists and journalism students, and it certainly changed the way that I think and educated me a great deal about how the world has changed and how we have to understand the militarization of civilian life to be good journalists. Well, Rosa Brooks, thank you so much for coming to the Graduate School of Journalism and participating today in this podcast. This has been Deirdre English, and this is On Mic. And thank you for coming.
Thanks so much, Deirdre.
We've been listening to Deirdre English in conversation with Rosa Brooks, author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. This has been On Mic, a podcast presentation of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Technical facilities for On Mic are underwritten by the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation. Kat Shuknecht and Alex Orlando are our producers, and I'm Dean Ed Wasserman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us next time for On Mic.